And that's the kicky music. That means it's time for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Trey Graham, sitting in for Linda Holmes, who's at an undisclosed location, within reach of a glass of wine and within earshot of a solo banjo, if I understand correctly. I do have the rest of the crew with me, though, plus one of your favorite guests. And this week we're going to lead off the show by admitting our growing affection for people we once underestimated. We will then turn our attention to game shows and what makes a good one. And we might or might not have a pop quiz of the regrettable sort. But before we kick things off, let's make some introductions. Stephen Thompson, you do something interesting here at NPR, do you not?
I do something at NPR. I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what keeps you busy?
I write about books and comic books at the NPR website.
Over there in the special guest chair, Barry Hardiman, are you awake?
Barely.
Are you wearing a blue velour jumpsuit of some sort?
Guilty. So guilty.
We should tell the nice people who you are and why you're wearing blue velour.
I am Barry Hardiman. I normally work at Talk of the Nation. However, for the last 4 weeks, I have been on an overnight rotation at Morning Edition, which means I am working 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., which the good people on the show do all the time and not just for 4 weeks, so I should not complain.
But do the good
but
people...
But I'm going to.
Do the good people on the show have newborn infants
also
at home?
Have infants?
People with newborn infants have done that. I mean, and the truth is that, you know...
That probably makes it easier.
Right. I've been up all night recently, so this is something... I've not been up all night and had to, you know, edit sentences together in ways that make sense or, you know, talk about Libya.
You're used to editing the sentences. Why won't he stop crying?
Exactly.
All right, people. Well, we are glad that you were able to drag yourself out of bed and get here for the taping. People... It is no secret that we are fond, some of us, of a young fellow named Justin Timberlake, who started off as a kid musician, but then grew into a not bad actor. More surprisingly, he turned into this goofy, funny, good-natured person who seems like he might just be a decent guy, right? At least in terms of the persona he's putting out with things like his appearances on Saturday Night Live and the Beyonce Single Ladies thing and Jimmy Fallon and the like.
Well, first of all, maybe you underestimated Justin Timberlake.
I didn't say it well.
I was going to say. Oh,
but let's talk, first of all, about how awesome Justin Timberlake's solo albums are. Second of all, let's talk about the fact that Justin Timberlake has more recently been spotted sporting an NPR t-shirt.
There is that.
Mm-hmm. Meaning he is there, therefore one of us.
I don't actually want to spend too much time because we have talked about Justin Timberlake.
No,
we have covered him and his NPR t-shirt and his new movie In Time quite enough.
So, I must say that we had underestimated J.C. Chassez. I just want to say I wish that had happened. But moving on.
Oh, I think we properly estimated J.C. Chassez.
Yeah, I know. That makes me sad.
I estimated him the exact right amount.
Well done.
Anyway, it is Timberlake and his new movie In Time that made us think that we might go around the table and give some love to other people we might originally have dismissed or overlooked or underestimated, but who have grown on us over the years, more or less in the manner of a strangely agreeable fungus. Glenn Weldon,
Well, I think I speak for all pretentious jerks when I say I was one of the people who was growing tired of the multi-camera filmed before a live studio audience sitcom way before the rest of America.
With a laugh track, you mean?
With the laugh track, right. So I'm going to make a shattering announcement here akin to the one Trey made last week about The Simpsons. I never watched Friends. Never watched Seinfeld. I absorbed them because they were part of the culture. They were inescapable.
You had the Rachel.
I wore the Rachel for a time on my eyebrows. But there was something about the thudding, implacable rhythm of setup, punchline, laugh track, setup, punchline, laugh track that I just, you know, and I turned to things like Larry Sanders Show and later Arrested Development because, again, as a card-carrying comedy nerd slash pretentious jerk, that's kind of where I was. I knew ostensibly from the outside that the jokes on Seinfeld and Friends were better than the jokes on your Carolines in the City.
That is the most pompous way anyone has ever spoken of that show.
You're the single guys.
I believe it's singles guy. No.
You're the single guy. You're Veronica's closets. So when I heard in 2005 that Lisa Kudrow was coming out with an HBO comedy series.
Oh, I know where this is going.
That she was producing and co-writing, I was like, vanity project. I was aware of her work.
See, now I felt the same way about the eighth baseball movie Ed with Matt LeBlanc.
So I'd seen her in Romy and Michelle. She was fun in that, but she was basically Phoebe. Mm-hmm. I'd seen her in a really good movie called The Opposite of Sex, a Don Ruse film. She was good in that. But
that's the one with Christina Ricci, right?
Yes. Yeah. She carried the stink, the mark of must-see TV with her, and I dismissed her. So I watched the comeback with that. Mm. All right, smelly cat girl. Bring it. Show me what you got. And it did truly bring it.
It did bring it.
It was rotten.
Valerie Cherish, ladies and gentlemen.
Valerie Cherish. It's a 13-episode mock documentary that follows a faded sitcom star as she gets a role, a minor role, in a truly terrible multi-camera film before a live studio audience sitcom. She plays Aunt Sassy. She's got a catchphrase. Now, when I talk to people about this show
now... I
think
she has a sweatsuit, too.
She does.
Yes, that's
like
right.
Just like me.
That's right. Valerie Cherish costume. When I talk to people about it now, the people who've heard of it think of it as a cringe comedy, and it has that aspect to it. But as much as I love Curb Your Enthusiasm, that show has a deliberately loose improv feel because it is deliberately loose in improv. The comeback has jokes, solid jokes. And because what Lisa Kudrow is doing is so precise and so specific, she knows this person very well, all these jokes really land.
Well, I got it.
Valerie?
Yeah.
Could you do it again?
Sure, yeah. Was there a technical
something? No, I just, I think it could be a little bigger, you know, more excited.
Can do. Okay. Ready? Well, I got it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just the whole comeback is about how excited you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am excited.
Right, but they didn't let us film them actually telling you, so this needs to be the big event.
Right, okay. Sure, I gotcha.
Okay.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I got it. And I thought it would...
Could you do it again?
you know, Jane, I'm sorry, I don't want to look like an idiot, you know, and this is supposed to be reality.
Yeah, well, I just think that your reality could be more excited. Just one more, just for safety.
Fine. Yeah, okay.
Bigger.
Okay, you know what, Jane, you and I have to talk. Can you turn the cameras off, please?
No.
Then I'm done. Okay, with this part. Okay? Because I can't. I have a table read, and, you know. Well, I got it! All right, you can't use that. Okay? That was a crazy person, and you cannot use it. And I need to know that I'm being heard.
Okay. Okay. We're done.
Good. Thank you.
Now she's doing a show called Web Therapy, which started out as a web series. It's now a Showtime series. I don't think it's as strong as The Comeback, but it's pretty great. And she's easily one of my favorite performers. So from nothing to one of the people I seek out.
Yep, absolutely. I wholeheartedly endorse that endorsement.
Yeah.
Ditto.
Barry Hardiman.
Ditto.
What have you got for us?
Well, you know, I chose somebody that I realize now many of you might have estimated properly. I like Cheers.
Yeah, Cheers
Heresy.
Is great.
I mean, but I like it. I'm not like one of these people that,
you're not like Comedy Genius,
right? Yeah, I mean, I thought it was very good, and there are important episodes, and I recognize its, you know, stature in the history of television, whatever, but I was particularly not really a Ted Danson fan.
Mm-hmm.
His second act, I think, has been just marvelous.
You're talking about Becker?
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say.
I'm going to go with your good point, third act. Bored to Death, in which he plays George Christopher, who is a loose interpretation of Graydon Carter, and is just, I mean, his comic timing is marvelous.
See, now that's the way to handle yourself on Cabot. Be cool, manly, world-weary. You know, show a capacity for sin. Play the rascal.
Mm. And... should I cross my legs like this or like this? Crotch open or crotch closed? Ray says crotch open.
Yeah, I differ from Ray on this point. I think that the closed crotch is more sophisticated and it keeps them guessing.
Okay, that does seem more natural.
I really want you to hit it out of the park tonight. With all the bookstores closing, this could be your last shot at literary success.
Oh, God.
He's got this goofy, marvelous, wide-eyed innocence to his man who's seen everything, which is just marvelous. And it's kind of the happy side of this character he played on Damages,
mm-hmm.
Frobisher, which is, by the way, a great drinking game to play with that particular season of Damages. But I realized that he's actually, there's a lot more there. And I never watched Becker, but I...
it's outstanding.
But I sort of like
I think that is not the
that
consensus opinion. opinion on that.
Right. But I'm a big fan of these. For instance, Kelsey Grammer also has a new show out now that is
Boss,
which he's actually good in. I mean, the show is not perfect, but he is really magnetic.
Because he's had a couple of strikes.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Right, but he's also had a couple of big, I mean, Cheers is terrific, Frasier, as we discussed
recently. Right, he certainly had a more distinguished sitcom career than Ted Danson, post-Cheers career. So anyway, Ted Danson was going to be my contribution to this, and Bored to Death this season is really just delightful and
wonderful. I like
that,
and I like that you highlighted the contrast between Bored to Death and Damages, because you're right, they are absolutely two sides of the same coin. There's the one guy who has been nothing but corrupted by his wealth and power, and then there's the other guy who certainly has a sense of privilege, but is a little boy lost, a little bored to death, a little, you know.
And neither character had any sense of themselves at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful thing to watch. I mean, he's physically, you know, his big, tall body with the hand, and on both shows, he does physical things that I think are really quite marvelous. Mm-hmm. So, bravo, Ted Danson.
Yay, well done. Stephen Thompson.
If I had a nickel for every commentary that I ended with, bravo, Ted Danson.
You and Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, dear.
That's right. My choice is somebody I never thought that I would be saying, oh, you know who produced a really ingenious piece of writing? Russell Brand.
Yes, indeed.
Most of us around this table at some point read Russell Brand's essay on his blog, russellbrand.tv, about the death of Amy Winehouse. Everybody generally interpreted and forwarded it around and talked about it as, you know, wow, this is just a lovely eulogy for somebody who has obviously, you know, been one of these kind of train wreck people.
Yep.
This is so nice. You know, have you read this? What stood out to me about it was the crispness and the clarity of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to think of Russell Brand, first of all, as kind of some of the characters that he has played in some of these movies, like Forgetting Sarah Marshall or whatever, you know, as kind of a bratty, unctuous twerp.
Have you seen his stand-up, though?
I have not spent a lot of time with his stand-up.
He is a smart, funny, politically engaged, sharp cookie.
And I think you start to realize that some people are very different from the characters that they play. Mm-hmm. And some people are simply, in the characters they play, magnifying some of the irritating things about themselves.
Yep.
I got the sense reading this as he talks very, very frankly about his own addiction and his own battles and what it has taken for him to get clean. I was just very taken aback because you just think, here's a guy who is that guy who's married to Katy Perry, you know, who is another person I think is a little bit smarter than she lets on. It just sort of,
although there was that hat.
Yes. Although there was.
She doesn't let on much.
was it David Itzikoff at the New York Times who referred to that as a Tetris accident? basically sort of forced me to reassess him and not to instinctively kind of reflexively dismiss him.
Yeah.
Particularly, you can never say that's a dumb guy.
Scott Simon on Weekend Edition did an interview with him back in March of 2009 when his memoir came out, which is, you know, ridiculously titled My Bookie Wook.
And see right there.
Yeah, but no, it's good reading. I haven't read the whole book. I'd read the first chapter, I think, when we were putting this.
You read the interior flap
when
of the dust jacket.
When I was putting the web page together. Exactly. There's a lovely audio excerpt on the NPR website where he reads a sequence that explains how he wound up naked on the street at 3 a.m.
You're talking about Russell Brand and not Scott Simon?
Yes, not Scott Simon. Naked on the street at 3 a.m. With nothing but a pink umbrella to shield his modesty. So, bottom line, short...
What a meeting of the minds, Russell Brand and Scott Simon.
Indeed. So, bottom line, yeah, smart guy, funny guy, and I think a little more thoughtful than many people give him credit for being.
Yeah. Still not going to get me into the Arthur remake.
Oh, no.
I'm not saying you have to go back and enjoy all of his movies.
That's a non-starter, I'm afraid. So I'm going to... This is... God, especially after last week, this is going to be so obvious, and you're all just going to groan.
I really underestimated...
Dame Maggie Smith.
No. Maggie Smith, I got from the moment I saw her.
No, when I first laid eyes on Judi Dench, I thought...
You know, you could actually do this with Helen Mirren because of Caligula.
You totally could.
I just want to say that.
Caligula. Yeah. Absolutely.
You could do anything with her in Caligula. So sorry, Mrs.
But you are in the ballpark, all of you, because mine is Gillian Anderson.
I was
never a gigantic X-Files fan. I obviously sort of understood its currency as a pop culture phenomenon. But then along came Terrence Davies' House of Mirth. And then in 2005, or at least that, I think
we're all just smirking, and I feel like we should be smirking audibly.
Yeah, well, Glenn's snoring, although for a minute I thought it was Barry.
No, I was going,
Yes, see, Barry's with me on this. Yeah, in 2005, she played Lady Deadlock in the 8-hour adaptation.
Oh, my God.
The 8-hour BBC adaptation.
Sweet, merciful God.
It's so good.
Of Bleak House.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
And, and seriously, I realized just from the enervated way in which she delivers her opening line that it's going to be a really great ride.
Is it still raining, my love?
Yes, my love.
Remarkable.
And I am bored to death with it.
Well.
Bored to death with this place, bored to death with my life, bored to death with myself.
What was that, my love?
Nothing of consequence.
Mr. Tulkinghorn will be coming soon. Certain legal matters to discuss, he says. Perhaps there's been a development in Jarndyce and Jarndyce.
Nothing ever happens with Jarndyce and Jarndyce.
No. Well.
So, Lady Deadlock, as the hilarious Wikipedia entry about Bleak House puts it, is the haughty mistress of Chesney Wold.
Oh, of course.
Oh,
and let's just say that it's important to understand that...
And the handsome young stranger who turns the world...
Well, actually, it's something like that.
Let's just say that... That's because they all are!
Well, actually, there's no one...
No, this
doesn't
Bleak
work
House.
That way.
No, Bleak House is not that kind of...
It is important to understand about this performance and about the story in particular, that while she is the haughty mistress, she was at one time also a naughty mistress. So she has a deep, dark secret, and she essentially dies of grief and guilt. You will understand why this character appeals
See,
to
now
me
you don't
so
have
much.
To spend 8 hours.
And so does Gillian Anderson's performance, which is just magnificently icy in the beginning and opens up in a very nicely measured way to become something much more vulnerable by the end. And she dies very prettily indeed.
She does.
Next to a cemetery in the rain.
With a pink umbrella. No.
It's not but a pink umbrella.
Now, hold on. Is that a horrible spoiler? You didn't just spoil this.
It's Bleak House.
It's Bleak House.
You all wrote your... I just want to just double check.
Stephen's mother would call you on it.
You all wrote your term papers on Bleak House. You may not remember how they
ended. I didn't write my term paper on Bleak House.
So I'm sorry if we've spoiled it for you, but it's Dickens. It's a couple of hundred years old. It's your own fault. Gillian Anderson is a person I have perhaps underestimated. And so I may go back and look at some of the X-Files to see if she's just grown tremendously or if that talent was always really evident.
It was, but it was buried for most of the series run because she wasn't asked to do much more except, where's the proof, Mulder? Over and over again.
Right.
She brought more to it later on as she, you know, became mysteriously pregnant and mysteriously not pregnant and then got abducted and then didn't get abducted and then for somebody
you're saying
had
her
to
character
pretend,
became less plausible.
Exactly. She had to pretend not to see Little Green Men even though the Little Green Men were there.
Yeah.
she was convincing at that.
Well, good. Yeah, she's terrific with little tiny moments, closely observed bits of internal monologue where you can sort of see the thought process kind of flickering behind her eyes. And I love that kind of acting. Gillian Anderson, the last of several people we are reevaluating, come to the Facebook page or to the blog and tell us about people you've changed your mind about over time.
Maybe Stephen Thompson.
It might. I was going to lead off with Stephen Thompson. Because, you know.
Most people at first overestimate me.
Yeah.
Well, you're tall.
They learn.
They learn how little there really is there. Speaking of how little there is here, Stephen Thompson will be, I believe, staycationing in the near future.
Yes.
As we were discussing the things he might do to occupy his time, we landed on the topic of game shows and how much he enjoys them. So we wanted to have a conversation about the sort of place of game shows in the pop culture history of the United States and perhaps beyond.
So we're going to start.
For those of you that did not write your term paper on Bleak House.
I would be much more likely to have written my term papers on, for example, Dream House.
Match game.
The short-lived 1983 game show in which newlywed couples could win a prefabricated house.
That's awesome.
Card Sharks.
Did it come
from
a Sears kit?
I'm sure it did. I was thinking it would be a great sort of like This American Life story to find those houses.
Oh, it would be.
The only problem...
There are a bunch right here in D.C. in Tacoma Park.
And the only problem is I don't think anybody remembers the 1983 game show Dream House. Mm. But you wonder sort of what becomes of a house that you win on a game show 29 years ago.
I always wonder what becomes of those couples who get married on television.
I wonder, what becomes of most couples who get married.
Oh, dear. So actually what we're going to talk about here is our fondness for game shows and the trouble or the success people have had in sort of bringing that format into the 21st century, right? It's worth remembering that back in the 50s, game shows were to television and to pop culture what American Idol was to television and pop culture at its very peak. Mm-hmm. It was very much must-know water cooler conversation topic, right?
Right.
There's perhaps a reason that those two things came to mind, because the early game shows, the ones around which there was a gigantic scandal in the late 50s, were in fact early reality television. They were scripted and planned, and the producers chose who was going to win. That's what happened with Quiz Show, which, as an aside, if you haven't seen the 1994 movie...
Such a good movie!
So good. These things were so sort of important in the zeitgeist that when that scandal broke, you know, there was a grand jury investigation in New York. There were congressional hearings. The president spoke up and talked about what a cruel thing it was to do to the American people.
Well, Barack Obama just said the same thing about the new Fear Factor.
Oh, I thought it was about the Kardashians.
Right.
So then you move into an era that's, you know, that's regulated, in fact, where the networks have standards and practices looking over the shoulder to make sure the games are fair, and you get properties like Price is Right, Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy. Those come along a little bit later. Those three brands in particular, Price is Right, Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune, they're still around. Does anybody still pay attention to them? Do they have the kind of currency that they used to have? And if not, why not? And what's replaced them?
First of all, the tie-in between game shows and reality shows, you know, should not be obviously, you know, completely absent from this discussion because competition-based reality shows are absolutely game shows.
They're game shows with a more urgent narrative overlaid on top.
Or in the case of Real World Road Rules Challenge, with a lot of tequila overlaid on top.
There we go. Game shows with booze. That's right. Barry Hardiman, what game shows do you watch or have you watched?
Yeah, and especially have you watched? What are the game shows sort of near and dear to your
heart? So I really don't watch them anymore. The closest thing that, you know, really is the sort of in the American Idol vein. But when I was a kid, this is really funny. We watched, I think Wheel of Fortune came on at 7 and Jeopardy came on at 7:30.
Still does.
And the nightly news ended at 7. We did not watch Wheel of Fortune. We turned the TV off. My mother was not into it. It was that in our family, Wheel of Fortune was considered somewhat déclassé.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But then we turned that sucker back on for Jeopardy.
Sure.
And I still, you know, I still now want to, I feel a little nervous when I see, you know, the letter. I think, oh my God, does my mother know I'm watching this? You know, I mean, this is from a woman who tapes Real World Rules Challenge, as I like to call it, But Jeopardy, I have a real, you know, affinity for. I always really loved it. And does anyone else have that feeling about the difference between Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy?
Sure.
Or is it only my mother?
Wheel of Fortune was so flashy and gaudy, and just the production design of it was so less contained than Jeopardy. They could not have been more opposite, right?
Well, you shouldn't be talking about in the past tense. They're still
on. That's true. Yeah.
And they're still on at the same time.
But I do think...
Is the girl... What's her face?
Still there.
Vanna White is still there.
The girl. Very
ageless.
Lady.
Yes, very
ageless.
Well preserved. Yeah. But if you...
Pat Sajak's hair, not
pixelated.
So much.
Even Wheel of Fortune has certainly made, you know, some not-so-subtle tweaks over the years. If you recall, they used to take their prize money at the end of each round and have to pick a bunch of worthless prizes, and it would always come down to, like, the wicker duck. $100. Just be like, they're going to get taxed on that wicker duck.
And would you like the rest on a gift certificate or on account?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I always tune in. The thing I always tune into is the Jeopardy when it's college week, because then I feel like a god among men. They really dumb the show down.
Yeah.
And in fact, anything
with grade schoolers.
That's right. Do you get the sense that a show, not like Jeopardy, but certainly a show like Your Price is Right, like Supermarket Sweep, I always picked up a sort of disdain for the common man, a sort of Hollywood looking down on the common man in those kind of shows. On Supermarket Sweep, which was a show where couples, or, you know, just two dudes who had the same sweatshirt on, just buddies hanging out, getting really excited about Swiffer wet jets, you know, they're not gay.
No.
They just get really excited, and there's a thing about making people get really excited, jump up and down for things like Zebrick and press board entertainment centers. You know, am I only the one picking up on that? Because I do feel there's a certain snideness.
I feel like maybe the disdain for the common man was coming from you.
Well, Stephen, I take your point, because I do care about celebrities and not people, which is why a show like Family Feud always left me cold.
Because I loved Family Feud.
Family Feud is still on?
Yeah,
well, it comes on again.
On its 700th different host.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, but oh my God, Steve Harvey's really funny.
Here's why I don't like it. First of all, families. Ugh. Second of all, the idea of the show, the way you get this show, is not by being exceptional or having knowledge, but by naming the same thing that everybody else named.
Right, in other words, appealing to the lowest common denominator.
No, by how quickly you access the hive mind. That's how you win the show. So this is why I always preferred a spin on that very same concept, where you're not matching your answer to the hoi polloi. You're matching your answer to six drunk minor television celebrities. I am talking about Match Game.
Yes.
Awesome. I was thinking maybe you were going for Password until we got to six drunk minor celebrities.
No, that show, man. that show also taught you a lot about layering humor, because whenever there was a question, there was the obvious dirty answer, but that was forbidden. So you had to kind of give it a spin. It actually taught me a lot about layering humor. And it also, this actually gives you access to what celebrities are like outside of the talk show environment, which is very structured, where they're coming on to give a pitch. You're actually seeing them interact. On Hollywood Squares, you sometimes saw the same thing, but that never really made it for me, because they're just as drunk. Well, I'll give you that. But they had writers feeding them jokes.
Yeah, they'd been coached.
Had been coached. So you're not really getting an access to them.
Yeah.
You did on Battle of the Network Stars, which I mentioned before, from the 70s.
Why there is not still Battle of the
there
Network Stars?
There should be. You don't have Cosell. Cosell was kind of the glue that held that thing together.
Get Michaels. Get Al Michaels to host Battle of the Network Stars. I would so watch that!
But you learn thing about these people you don't learn in any other environment. You learn that Gabe Kaplan's kind of a jerk, you know? He's kind of with his headband, his velour headband. Which is why the show that I missed the most was Celebrity Poker Showdown. Ooh. You see celebrities come on, and A, you figure out how drunk they get, how drunk they allow themselves to get, how much they listen to the guy who gave them a very basic instruction on how to play poker, but also how they play and how they interact with each other. It's a fascinating show that I thought was the most direct access to people that if you're mildly interested in it, it's a great thing.
The show that I loved. One thing that I definitely learned from watching these shows, and I've watched a lot of Match Game and a lot of Hollywood Squares, is as a child having no concept whatsoever of gaydar. that some of these flamboyantly dressed boys liked other boys.
Yeah.
And so I believe it wasn't until Paul Lynde died and I read his obituary and I was like, gay, huh?
You just thought he had an odd speech pattern.
I just thought he talked he talked kind of like Charles Nelson Reilly. I thought it was just a thing.
Yeah. I have some heartbreaking news about Charles Nelson Reilly. Steven.
It's like, oh, I thought he was cool. But I used to pretend to be sick so that I could stay home watching game shows, watching Card Shark. And there was a block of them.
Card Shark, yeah.
From 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning until the dreaded soap operas began.
Oh, see, and that's where I came along.
That was where I started to feel better and thought about going to school.
I had to make it to all my children.
Do you guys remember that Alex Trebek used to host Card Sharks back in the day? Do you guys remember that he had a reputation for being sort of short and easily exasperated with guests who were dumb? Remember that?
Really?
Trebek? I can't imagine.
It's a three. Why would you say lower?
Lower is he? Oh, my God.
Yeah, they made fun of it. That's what the SCTV skit High School High Q, I think it's called.
Oh, man.
Where basically Alex Trebek, an Alex Trebek character, just constantly gets exasperated with very dumb answers to questions.
I did, as we discussed on the show a few weeks ago, watch the High Quiz Bowl hosted by the Menards guy.
Yeah.
And his sort of smug disdain for a man who did not know that it was pronounced can.
Yeah.
Oh, such fun.
Trey, I don't think we actually got to any of your overarchings. Well, since the dawn of time.
All right, well, it's sort of halfway jokingly set up the question of, theoretical and philosophical questions about game shows, but I do want to propose the notion that there are two types of game shows. One in which the host and the producers like the contestants, and one in which the hosts and producers like to torment the contestants.
Right.
In the latter, I'm thinking of the models behind some of the newer TV shows that have been very successful in the 21st century. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The Weakest Link? Even something as stupid as, what was it called, Downfall? That thing where they would run the prizes off the end of the building?
Or something like Deal or No Deal, where it's like, oh, you screwed up! Or, let's wait another 5 minutes to open another case.
Based entirely
on guessing.
Random guessing.
Yes.
I do think that says something about the way the audience has been trained to respond to not just people who live inside this small box, but, to each other, really. And on that depressing note, I'm just going to say that my favorite game show ever was Name That Tune.
Oh, Name That Tune. That's one. I bet that's not in syndication because of the licensing.
Right.
Probably, yeah.
There definitely are a lot.
Charge you through the nose for Camptown Ladies.
I can name that tune and do it.
There are, you know, certainly, I think, more sort of punishment-oriented shows these days. I mean, to the point of where you have a show like, have you ever seen Solitary?
No.
Where they basically just put you in like a self-sensory deprivation chamber and torture you until you give in.
That sounds delightful. It sounds just very, very exciting.
Years and years ago, I got to interview Bob Barker, which until you've picked up the phone and had Bob Barker be on the other end, you have not lived. Yeah. But I remember Bob Barker saying in this interview that one thing that he always felt as a host is every time in any situation, he always wanted the person to win.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's something he passed along to Drew Carey that I think is still prevalent in The Price is Right today. It's no skin off anyone's rear end.
Right.
If every single contestant walks away with cars and trips and whatever, there's not this sort of, well, at the end of the show, ha, 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 you guys both sucked. You went over. Nobody wins. Like, they're bummed. They want everybody to win.
Yeah, they're sad.
One of the things I kind of like about Alex Trebek, and I can believe that he was once sort of had a shorter temper, is that he's got that school marmy, like, well, you didn't study, did you? Kind of about it when you don't get the Daily Double. Like, oh, I'm sorry, that's not the name of the Egyptian mistress of Ka. Or whatever, right. You know, I mean,
like, duh. Like,
exactly. And I actually kind of love that about
him. Yeah, I kind of like it too. It's pronounced Nicaragua.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think we can all agree that that Jeopardy and The Price is Right are both examples of television that we like a great deal.
For people who have not seen some of these shows, particularly some of these older shows, I do recommend, of course, The Game Show Network.
Yeah.
I was scanning their listings in preparation for this segment, and I was really enjoying the fact that at 2 a.m. Eastern, you can watch on The Game Show Network The $25,000 Pyramid.
Oh, I love that.
Which I loved. Oh, Betty White. You find out how smart a lady Betty White is watching that show.
That's true. But Password, too.
But then at 2:30 a.m., you get the $100,000 Pyramid.
Right.
So in case you were thinking about going to bed, so then
the stakes go up.
Hell, I'm working.
So yeah, that's right. Barry's at work. 3 a.m., you get a little Card Sharks.
Good then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 3:30 a.m., more Card Sharks. And then 4 a.m., paid programming.
Yeah.
And
seriously, you just think, they don't follow Card Sharks with The Joker's Wild?
No, there is no Joker's Wild, which is a show I loved.
Sad
along
about
with
that.
The Joker's Wild and Press Your Luck, two shows that I was obsessed
Press
with as
your
a child.
Luck.
At 4 a.m., imagine how monumentally, soul-crushingly depressing it must be to be sitting
still
there
awake
with your, you're just eating an
your
entire
hot pocket,
just eating an entire hot pocket in the dark, watching Card Sharks, and then all of a sudden there's an infomercial, and you're like, well, now it's just the middle.
It's the handy chopper.
And I'm out of hot pockets.
Uh-huh. And that is what we would all agree is probably some regrettable television watching right there. Speaking of which, Stephen Thompson.
Yes.
We have decided to revisit this category, not least because last week, quite by accident, I stumbled across a show that I think might just win this category forever and all eternity.
Hmm.
So I am, and thus it will spell an end to our little game, if I am correct.
Oh, I don't know. So,
so I'm going to go last. We are going to choose at random, as always, from one of the clips that you all have brought.
Hey there, your high princess-ness. Could you kind of, you know, quit chucking those things at my friends? So anyway, look what I found. Mahjong. The most awesome tile-based game ever. Weichi? Yobo? Sudochi? Come on! If you don't like games, what do you like?
You and the princess buddies yet?
It's a process.
This is vaguely familiar, but darn if I can put a name
is
to it.
Is this the imitation Kung Fu Panda show?
This is fake Kung Fu Panda.
Oh,
this is Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness with fake Jack Black.
With a very convincing
convincing fake. But yeah, I mean, who am I kidding? It's a very good Jack Black. I like the fact that when you go through the cast listing, it's all these non-movie people until you get to Lucy Liu.
Lucy Liu doing voice work.
Yeah.
So do you watch this thing?
No.
So how is it different?
There is also a Madagascar animated series called The Penguins of Madagascar, which my kids enjoy, and which, you know, what little I've seen of it, because usually I put it on and then flee, and certainly hope that nothing objectionable happens on TV. Generally, they're actually pretty competently put together. It's not going to live up to Kung Fu Panda.
So is it supposed to be the same
characters? Yes, it's all the same characters. Right. It is a...
So it is a spin-off.
And it's, it's sort of that animation style light, you know, obviously being mass-produced for television, you're not going to get each individual painstakingly computer-rendered hair on that beautiful, beautiful panda's body. I don't mean to sexualize the panda.
I was
going to
say, we had crossed the line into furry love. Mike Katzif, what else do you have for us?
One time, I do restaurants, and here I am, I'm channeling, and all of a sudden I'm like, I couldn't believe my eyes, so I said, who lost a ferret? Because I was seeing a squirrel, but who has a pet squirrel? Well, shut up. There was a person in the audience that had a pet squirrel. And I swear to you, I said, who's Stevie? And I thought the guy and the girl were going to fall off their chair. They said, oh my God, Stevie. And I said, did you have a pet ferret? And she said, serious? No, that was our pet squirrel. I said, no way. They actually had a pet squirrel, and they named it Stevie. And I go, you had the squirrel cremated. The mother, I go, your mother's telling me she's cremated the squirrel, and she has them on the mantle with their pictures. I swear to God. Crazy? That has to be the craziest animal story. Who has a squirrel as a pet?
Any guesses?
At first I was thinking that this was somehow an Animal Planet show about a pet psychic who happened to befriend Drescher's younger sister.
No, right. No.
That would have been my guess, too.
I do have to go with something Animal Planet.
Yeah.
But they don't do psychic. They don't do this psychic nonsense,
they had a pet psychic.
Well, it's clearly a pet psychic.
Right. This is... she's not simply a pet psychic. She's talking about the time that she has channeled a pet. She is the Long Island Medium.
Oh,
her name is Teresa Caputo, as you might be able to guess. It's on the Learning Channel.
Because,
as we know, exploiting the emotions of grieving loved ones
is a learning experience.
It's all about the learning. I went to school on Long Island, and there was a time when I could tell from my classmates' accents exactly where on the island they were from, like how far in they were. But I've lost that
you
ability.
You sound like Merrick.
That's right. Is it Great Neck? Is it Ronkonkoma? Is it Massapequa? You know where she's not from. I can tell. Ask me where she's not from.
Where is she not from?
Quag. It's too far out. But the accent isn't the thing here. It's we have to link to the video because you have to see the bubble helmet hair, the dark roots, the fingernails. This show is Carmela Soprano, Ghost Whisperer. And for a woman who makes a living rending the veil between the living and the dead so that she may commune with her unquiet spirits, she seems remarkably phased by a squirrel.
That's a really good point.
Also, did you catch in the very beginning, she says, I do restaurants. What does that mean? What does I do restaurants mean?
Did she have an act?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I just want to tell you, the veal has some unfinished business that is preventing it from crossing over. So I'm watching the show. I'm watching the show, and I always go back and forth with something like this. If you're a cynic like me, you go back and forth, well, is she crazy? Is she evil? Is it dementia? Is it mendacity? I don't know. Could be a little from column A. The fact, on her website, it says that she came to her gift, realized her gift after 9/11, which I think argues for evil. But that is Teresa Caputo, Long Island Medium.
That wins.
No.
We have two more, but that sets a high bar. Yeah. Mike Katzif.
You like my mustache?
Are you keeping it for the wedding?
Yeah.
Please talk him out of it.
You're going to wake up Saturday morning and shave it. Trust me.
She'll shave it or I'll shave it?
Together.
Like, this is all I feel like I have left is my mustache. It's the only way to send a message to Kim.
That is Chris Humphreys talking, isn't it?
That is literally now all he has left. Yes. Is that mustache. That is a clip from Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding, which the great thing about being on the overnight is that your DVR is still full of the ghosts of couples past. And
So you DVR'd that too.
We should explain for the NPR audience
that
Kim Kardashian
and Chris Humphries
are no longer together.
Yes.
Sadly, after 72 days, 72 long and difficult days, they are no longer together.
Our long
national nightmare has finally ended. But, ladies, Chris Humphries, he's available.
He is a tall fellow, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's an NBA player.
Yes.
He is, with huge hands. In the episode where he asks Bruce Jenner for her hand. He claps his hand on Bruce's back, and you can see, I mean, obviously it's all staged anyway, but there is a kind of like, well, I better say yes about it. Because, I mean, he's just got these big mitts.
Barry Hardiman, how much of this have you watched?
You know, I'm only awake for a little period of time, so I'm about 45 minutes through the
first
part.
You're
kidding.
Your ability to watch it on your DVR did not last as long as the marriage.
That is the part I love. I mean, and E is now scrambling to refill, because it's, you know, it's a constant... They're now scrambling to refill that time.
Gigantic gaping hole in their schedule.
But
it's
so much better, by the way, now post breakup. Everything. I mean, it's just so.
But it's watching all this with the added gloss of Schadenfreude.
Exactly.
Well, don't you always watch the Kardashians with the gloss of Schadenfreude?
That's true.
But I pour myself a gloss of Schadenfreude.
But I have not actually spent a whole lot of time with the Kardashians. But is it now that their lives?
I can tell because you still have that kind of pallor.
Because I knew all their names.
Exactly.
Somehow through osmosis, I have picked up all the names involved.
I actually have to confess that, like Glenn, I am barely familiar with the concept of Kardashian. I know that there is a Kim.
There is barely a concept. So that's,
And I gather that they are a loathsome clan, but that is the extent of my knowledge.
Some of them are just
watery. But I think I've seen enough of the show to know that.
I would actually say, based on the first 45 minutes of Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding, that she is truly loathsome.
Yeah, that does
truly,
not surprise
me. I've been planning for this wedding since I was 10 years old.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well. And in fact, there's this amazing bit. I can't remember who says it. All you need is a groom to slot in. You don't even care who you're marrying. And it's like,
That's a bitterly tragic thing to tell a family.
Actually, Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding could be subtitled, you know, Impending Divorce. Yeah. It's truly amazing.
Well, I'm going to present you with something that I think may not have registered, and you're going to be sad that it hasn't.
She has to have a life, but as far as the full package, I'll take Rihanna over Tyra Banks. I'm Rihanna all day. You're not going to take me off that. There's nothing you could Tyra Banks it, you could Sade it.
I'm with Michael on this one.
Are we talking about five heads, or are we talking about how hot Rihanna is?
No, nothing has to do with anybody being hot. It has to do with where your hairline is, and so far, how could you possibly say anyone's is higher than Sade? Sade starts combing her hair from the back of her neck.
James Vanderbeek.
Wow, you're just weird, because we're in the female, and then you keep throwing, like, you know, 90210, and then James Vanderbeek.
This guy is weird.
I got nothing. Anybody?
Love these references.
Steven's moaning as if he knows.
No, it's not some man show derivative of some kind, is it?
If you have ever asked yourself, whatever happened to Jay Moore? The answer is that he is the host of something called Master Debaters.
Speaking of people I did not underestimate.
Right.
Wow, yeah.
This is a show on something called Fuel TV, which appears to be a network made up entirely of massively regrettable television programming. It is basically four Broheims sitting on $12 worth of IKEA furniture wearing what appears to be the clothes they passed out in the night before. And they're debating, talking...
What's wrong with that?
Well, you know...
What you're describing is not that different from my game show.
This is true. You know, they're talking over each other about a series of highly arbitrary topics. Things like, what hobby is most likely to prevent you from getting some? And where does Tori Spelling rank
like
on the list
on
of Hollywood
show.
Butterfaces?
So,
in other words, it's kind of like this podcast, only without the thin veneer of respectability.
Which of us is the Jay Moore? I'm going to let that linger marinate in the air.
Seriously, if this is not the stupidest and least expensive television show in the history of regrettable television, I will sell all of my belongings and go try to make a celebrity of myself on the A-List Dallas.
The A-List Dallas.
All right, then. Well, unless anybody has any further thoughts on the topics of Jay Mohr and or Master Debaters, we're going to move on to the topic of what is making us happy this week. And I want to start with Barry Hardiman.
Well, there, besides Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding, parts one and dose, what's making me happy this week, I'm a little afraid to say it because it's quite possible that one or all of you hate the show, but I've discovered The League. It's a show on FX. It is filthy. I cannot tell you how filthy this show is. I can't quote any line from the show. It is so disgusting, and it is absolutely... I still have a little tiny cramp from when I doubled over in pain laughing so hard.
Okay, Barry, please tell me. I love everybody involved, remotely involved with the show.
You don't love it.
I've never seen it because it's the baseball league. I don't care from
the baseball league. Back us into this because it's
about...
Does that change you?
What is it?
that would have changed that.
It's about the footy ball.
Yeah, the footy ball.
It's barely about football.
Is it?
It is just... I think it's probably what Master what Master Debaters wants to be.
Okay.
It's a sort of a group of four guys who have a fantasy football league. You know,
I see Stephen Thompson perking up.
Yeah. They rib each other.
Well, tell them who's in it.
Paul Scheer, who I adore. You're probably going to know these comedians better than I do. They used to be on Best Week Ever.
Jason Manzakis, I think, is on.
Oh,
there.
My God. Yeah. Is he the one? Does he play Rafi?
I don't know their names. I just know that they're on the show.
I just stumbled upon this as a recommendation from a friend. It is...
So filthy
Nick Kroll.
Fantasy football.
Oh, Nick Kroll, is it? Yes, okay. Yes. Oh, yes. He plays Roxanne, and he's wonderful.
So we've got filthy fantasy football, comedians I like, and Barry acting like this.
It is.
I'm very confused.
You must see it. I think we're in the third season. Every episode so far has just, I mean, it is so disgustingly funny. I can't even, I'm so sad when my little 29 minutes are over. It's absolutely worth DVRing, and, and I would be interested to see what you fellas
all
have
right,
to say
the league.
About such
Count me
no
in.
Fair.
Count me in. Glenn Good. Weldon.
I just want to warn you, Trey Graham, that I'm going to win the gay off with this. I'm going to wrest that tiara off your weave.
As long as you don't leave the weave in the gutter.
So I was looking for something to watch this weekend, trolling, I wanted to see something on the long tail. Not a new release, but something buried in the archives of my cable provider's on-demand service. And I just kind of found something in the W's that I did not realize I was looking for, but I so was.
I mean, there was something great about growing up in a liberal, intellectual Jewish household with three sensitive older brothers. But there were times, I have to admit, that I really got caught up in the romance of being Gentile, especially around Christmas time. I would fantasize that I had an older brother named Chip and a little sister named Sally, and my name would either be Happy or Buffy or Babe. One of those big sexy blondes who plays a lot of volleyball. Yes! Spike it, babe! All right! Yes! And every Christmas Eve, my mom would make a glazed ham with cloves sticking out of it and a hot canned fruit compote. Mama!
Okay. That is Sandra Bernhardt's 1990 film, Without You, I'm Nothing. Actually, that's not the film itself because I couldn't find the clip online. That is from the off-Broadway show that the film is based on, the 1988 off-Broadway show. You can tell it's from the show, not the movie, because the conceit of the movie is that she's doing this act in front of an audience that hates her guts and they're constantly walking out. Watching that, I was reminded of what was so singular about Bernhardt then, the adopting of a very shallow, condescending persona to satirize the shallow and condescending, which is kind of what Sarah Silverman's doing now, without the fame celebrity obsession that she had. The film does several things that the stage show didn't, including a really brilliant dialogue about going to Andy Warhol's estate sale. And there's some new songs. It's not perfect. There's an attempt at mock documentary that doesn't work. And, jokes about Madonna, I think, might have.
Oh.
There's lots of jokes in here about
Those will
Madonna.
Date.
That makes me so nostalgic.
And the film is really self-indulgent, but you can't ding a film for being self-indulgent when its whole point, it exists to mock self-indulgence. So I remember hating this film in 1990 when I saw it because I wasn't prepared for it. I only knew her from her Letterman appearances. I didn't know anything about the stage show. I also was a rugged heterosexual at the time, you might recall. I hadn't been yet bitten by the radioactive cater waiter.
It
that was still
I was going to say Sandra Bernhardt, who did it.
to do.
Yes. But man, this was just so much fun. So you can seek it out if you can. It's on DVD. It's Sandra Bernhardt's Without You, I'm Nothing.
Wow. Stephen Thompson.
Well, several things are making me happy. One is the return to supermarket shelves of eggnog.
Really?
But it's not that time of year, really?
No, it is, because it's on store shelves, which means I can acquire it and drink it. Also, I am embarking on a staycation. I will not be here next week.
That is true.
And one of the things that I will be doing is mainlining an entire saved-up season of Top Chef Just Desserts.
Oh, such fun. Yeah.
Which Glenn has discussed on this show before, and I finally got around to catching up with season one a couple months ago. And while we've all really enjoyed the line about you can just taste the resentment in her cookie, what you neglected to point out is the even better moment, which I will paraphrase as, "The Red Hots are for my mommy!"
Yay. Oh my God, I love that!
I wanted to let you discover that for yourself. I couldn't spoil it.
The Red Hots are for my mommy! I'm sure there is not a moment in season two.
There is nothing even approaching that crazy. It's okay, but it's nothing like the first.
Now, I'm sort of curious. I have to confess, I have not watched the dessert show, but I kind of think it's a great idea because, frankly, baking is much more of a science than cooking in a skillet is. Yeah. And if you mess up the souffle, as it were.
And they don't have recipes, so they have to kind of, can't imagine that.
Well, I'm psyched. I don't care how bad it is. I'm just going to be watching it in one big...
I might actually join you with that because it's been a while since
you're not allowed in my house.
Even Top Chef. I have the Netflix. So, very quickly, with Barry, I am very, very happy about the institution of marriage, which I understood to have been imperiled. It has now been shored up by the fact that a celebrity has belatedly realized the value of marriage and has thus decided to quit the establishment. So that's a good thing. Also, the news today, as we tape this, that the magician heist movie Now You See Me, which begins shooting in January, already has kind of an amazing cast. Some Jesse Eisenberg, some Morgan Freeman, some Woody Harrelson, some Dave Franco. There is a rumor... Michael Caine. Oh. It's about magicians who rob banks and pass out the money to their audiences the FBI chase. That is a movie I am looking forward to, if only to see how Michael Caine is going to, you know, talk in this movie. how the voice has evolved further. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Come tell us what's making you happy this week at facebook.com/PCHH. And, of course, we would be very, very happy if you would follow us on Twitter. I'm at Trey Graham, which is Trey with an E, and Graham like the factors used for determining ambiguity in U.S. patent law. Stephen Thompson is at I Dislike Stephen. That's with a P and an H. Glenn Weldon.
And an N.
Yes. Glenn Weldon is at G.H. Weldon. And the singular sensation that is Barry Hardiman may be followed at B. Hardiman. That's HARDYMON. And remember, she is working overnight, so if she's tweeting at 4 a.m., she is not necessarily under the influence.
I tweet late.
Mike Katziff is at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. And it is his band, Hello Come In, that provides our in-and-out music. Linda Holmes will be back next week. You can follow her, though she is not tweeting during her vacation, at NPR Monkey C. Thank you for being here, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening.